For tonight's edition of All Things Considered. Tonight, a discussion about the declining U.S. dollar and its effect on your pocketbook. All Things Considered will be followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our regional news magazine. Many of us think that the war in Vietnam was the first war that was brought into our homes by television. A new public television series, Eyes on the Prize, will remind us that the battle to integrate the South was really the first to shock us nightly on the evening news. We witnessed police clubbing peaceful demonstrators, unleashing police dogs to disperse the demonstrators, and spraying the protesters with high-pressure fire hoses powerful enough to strip the bark off trees. Such very dramatic footage is used to tell the history of the civil rights movement in the new public television series, Eyes on the Prize. The series begins tomorrow at 9 on Channel 12 in the Delaware Valley and continues for the next 5 Wednesdays at that time. My guest is the executive producer of the series, Henry Hampton, who is the president of Blackside Incorporated, the production company responsible for the series. He founded the company in 1968. Hampton lives in Boston, where he's the founding director of the Boston Center for the Arts and chair of the board of the Boston Museum of Afro-American History. Hampton also collaborated on the companion book for the public television series, which, like the series, is titled Eyes on the Prize. It's published by Viking. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
This is the second chance for you probably to see a lot of the news footage of the civil rights movement. Does it look very different to you now, 20, 25 years later, than it did when you were watching it on the news?
Well, it does, because every time you add a level of texture, which means talking to someone who was involved in one of those events or someone else who reacted to the footage, it takes on a richer dimension. And so once you begin to uncover this and enter into it, the simple icon is no longer one-dimensional. It takes on great layers.
What are some of your memories from the 1960s of when you were at home watching some of this on the news in the beginning when the footage was first coming over on TV? Was it shocking to you?
Well, it was. But I grew up a very comfortable middle class, or probably upper middle class environment. My father was a surgeon, a quite good one, and he took care of us well. And one of the ways that black parents took care of their children in those days was to keep them protected from this. So we never got taken south. And St. Louis at that point was pretty much a segregated city. But we simply never went to the movies or went to restaurants. We ate at home, and we went to good private schools. And
was it official segregation or de facto segregation?
De facto, although no one challenged it. So in reality, it's hard to tell. It may or may not have been on the books. In fact, in retrospect, it was on the books in cases, but it had long since been unenforced in a certain way. But why put up with that? And that was one of the ways that certainly the black middle class dealt with it in those times. It was in the 1960 when I was in my junior, senior year in college at Washington University in St. Louis. It's a place called Santoro's, which is right around the corner from the university. And some more of the activist students on campus responding to the Greensboro sit-ins. Decided we were going to open up Santoro's, and I had never been there, nor had I ever cared to go there particularly, but it quickly became a cause celeb around the campus, and most of it was by far a majority white campus. And we took some heat from our fellow students who really weren't very enthused about the sit-in movement, but we were able to desegregate that and other restaurants. The answer to the question about footage is that my first experience really was with that footage of the sit-ins, starting first in Greensboro, and it sort of swept across the South to other towns, and that gave us great initiative to go on after our own particular obstacles. And then I really moved away from it. I moved to Boston and went to work for the most Yankee of organizations, the Unitarian Universalist Association. It's the national headquarters of the Unitarian Church, and stumbled my way into a fairly good job, which was the director of information. So I was literally the press officer for the Unitarian Church. And then in 1963, the denomination, the year I started, got involved with the March on Washington. So I had a sense of that footage again, because many of the ministers of the church went down and played a key role at the march. And finally, in 1965, when really the height of the sit-in and civil rights movement, I ended up in Selma as a result of some of that footage, which was the footage on the bridge on a day that's called Bloody Sunday. It's part of show six in the series. And it was a time when a group of demonstrators attempting to walk across the bridge in response to the death of a man named Jimmie Lee Jackson were bloodied. And a lot of people saw that footage on national television, responded to it viscerally, got on airplanes and went south. One of them was a white Unitarian minister named James Reeb, and Jim was killed down there. And in response to his death, the denomination and I, along with them, went down there. And for me, it was not only the professional job of representing the denomination and handling press. I was, for the first time in my life, having the sort of one-on-one experience with segregation that my parents had protected me from. So I remember the footage and remember it well. Yeah.
So the footage has really played a very dramatic role in your life, as it did in the lives, I think, of many black and white Americans. How aware do you think the civil rights leaders were of the power of TV cameras, you know, of the dramatic impact this could have if it was actually brought home into people's living rooms? Because really, I think, you know, further on in the late 60s and the 70s, certainly in the 80s, people are very aware and really try to manipulate the press whenever they can. But I think people were less sophisticated about the press in the late 50s and in the early 60s.
Well, an interesting thing happens from this 10-year period. 54, you've seen the first program on Emmett Till and the Montgomery bus boycott. And even the killers of Emmett Till, who later confessed to Look magazine, talked to the cameras with almost an innocence and an openness that you would not expect. And the black folks as well respond. And media is almost like a friendly uncle that's listening to these events. By the time you get to show six, the attitude toward the press is quite different. And the media has learned, because they have been physically attacked and more than that, they have been made a target by the white South, that understands that the media is not their friend in exposing what has occurred down here. It has put an enormous amount of national attention and pressure on the system of segregation. So it goes in this 10 short years to from sort of wise teller of stories to hated enemy. And in fact, the press is physically attacked oftentimes.
That's an interesting point, because I think nowadays a lot of people tend to speak in vague euphemisms in front of the cameras or when they're speaking to the press, because they don't want to be pinned down. And if they're holding either controversial views or, you know, certainly if they're holding racist views, they're not going to come out and say it. Whereas people did actually just come out and state very openly racist views in the earlier parts of the series.
Well, that's also in part because most of America didn't take great exception to those views, so people felt more comfortable doing it. It was before the wrath of the nation had sort of gathered itself and come down on them. But the shift in attitudes in the press has also something to do with the question you asked about how is it used. And a couple of things happened over that 10 years. I mean, one is the press grows up on the kind of good story material that the civil rights movement provokes. These stories of simple people, I mean, applying, of federal troops protecting them, of kids walking into the school, of violence. The press, in a way, becomes fully aware that this makes these make good pictures, makes the graphics of the movement are good television. At the same time, the movement is aware that one of the few protective agencies that's available is, in fact, the press and their ability to send this picture out to the country and therefore offer protection that neither the federal government nor certainly state governments would offer. So they become very aware of it. Later, in about somewhere 62, 63, it becomes very clear that they're manipulating each other. The press wants to know where the confrontations are. They want to have the cameras set up in the same way that I think most cynically American cameras follow presidents around, because they want to be there in case someone takes a shot at them. The cameras used to follow movement players around, and they used to ask for information about when something bad was going to happen so that they would be there to get the pictures. The movement side became clearly aware that you could manipulate national public opinion, especially by certain kinds of pictures, and this was a symbiotic relationship that grew over that period. I have some opinions about the fact that it was to the detriment later of both organizations, but
how to the detriment of the civil rights movement because of the star system, the celebrity nature that some people took on with all the media coverage?
Well, that's certainly a part of it, but more importantly, I think the trouble is there, the television especially has an insatiable appetite for this kind of picture. And once the movement was no longer able to provide it in a certain way, it moved first quickly to the north and tracked the violence of the riots, and then it moved to Vietnam with almost as a beast that's constantly looking for certain kinds of disturbing and innervating pictures. Not that this stuff wasn't real, not that it wasn't important in our lives, but at some point, the other job that media has to necessarily do, the quieter job, the more analytical job, the sort of tracking now what the impact of the civil rights movement was having on the population, that job got ignored. And therefore, we watched the press shoot across to Southeast Asia and leave a major part of the story untold.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Henry Hampton, and he's the executive producer of the new series Eyes on the Prize, a public television series that documents the history of the civil rights movement. It's a 6-part series that you can see Wednesdays at 9, beginning tomorrow night on public television, Channel 12 in the Delaware Valley. What do you think is a turning point in which civil rights leaders start realizing the impact that the news footage is having on national consciousness?
Yeah, there are a lot of lessons learned in this process, and in retrospect, you can see them fairly clearly. I mean, one is Albany, where Martin King is literally defeated by a man named Laurie Pritchett. Marvelous story, because Pritchett to this day, and the people will see in the interview, is clearly a very charming man. He's a very smart man. He had read King's book. He understood how nonviolent tactics worked. So when the ministers of SCLC came unprepared into Albany, Georgia, Laurie beat him, and he beat him bad, because he expanded. He knew that the tactic was to fill the jails, and he simply expanded his number of jails to cover the three or four counties surrounding Albany. And that's a slick and clever way to deal with a protest. But if you know anything about those jails, they were deadly places for black people who often did not survive them. So it wasn't just a clever piece of strategy. He was risking and no doubt losing black lives in the process. That's the kind of story that I think has gotten lost in the retelling of the civil rights movement, which we hope this series will begin to get people to understand that people like Martin King weren't born full form as successful and national leaders, that they had to get fired by wins and losses along the way, as did the vast majority of the people who really made the civil rights movement, the sort of 90% of the civil rights movement that is never talked about, which is all these individuals, some in Washington, some in backwater southern towns, some northerners, all the people who literally collectively make up this period.
Who did you go to for the footage? I know you went to the networks. What about the local stations? Were the local stations in the South that were run by whites responsive to covering the demonstrations in the way that the national news media covered it?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a number of sources where you go, and part of the expense of a project like this, which totaled $3 million if you include the educational materials, but the production budget is 2.5 of that. And a big part of the cost is the stock footage, finding it, getting it reproduced, and getting it cleared for broadcast. Probably 65-70% of it came from the network archives. But more importantly, a lot of the network archive footage that we're using has not been on the air before because it's outtakes. And as you know, sometimes the much better stories exist in outtake form rather than the cut news story. And we were able to get in, because of the size of the project and I think the way we approached it, into those outtakes, and we used much of that footage. We also sent out searches to many of the local stations, who oftentimes would cover these stories before they attracted network interest. And we were lucky enough to find in several cases footage that had not made it into archives, had not been lost, but had been maintained. In fact, one of our heroes is a man named Duane Silty. He's 24 years old now. I'm sure he's a videographer and not a film person in the local Birmingham station. But there were all these cans of footage from the years of the Birmingham confrontation that were in the basement of the local station there. I can't remember the call letters now, but unlike at Montgomery, where just can upon can of footage of the early Montgomery bus boycott was thrown out about 10 years ago because a janitor decided it was taking up too much space. In Birmingham, they were going to do the same thing. They had all these cans of film, and nobody had, paid any attention to them for years, and they needed the space downstairs. But this young guy just said no. You know, he wouldn't let him throw it away. If he took it home with him, he held on to it just for instinctual reasons. So Dwayne Silte, I've forgotten the spelling and stuff, but Dwayne Silte of Birmingham, Alabama, is a hero because he hung on to stuff that probably for the first time gives people a sense of the power of those hoses you were talking about and the quality of the violence that was operating on the streets of Birmingham.
That's a great story.
Mm-hmm. There's another story, just if you want to wander
sure.
a bit, and that's that at one point the coaxial cable that was used for national network television during the years of the 15-minute national news broadcast ended at Oklahoma City. So in show two, although this story isn't in the film, when they shot the film of the Little Rock confrontation between troops and the Army and the desegregation of Central High, they just couldn't walk. They couldn't put it on the satellite because there was no satellite. They couldn't walk down to the local affiliate because there was no connection. They had to take it to Oklahoma City, which is a couple of hours away. And John Chancellor, who, like a lot of the current press, cut their teeth on this period, was the reporter for, I think it was NBC then, and he had to fly the footage to Oak City and get it transferred onto the cable so it would go back to New York. Now, John Chancellor apparently scared to death of flying in little airplanes, so he spent the only way he could do it was drink. So he apparently spent the whole 3 weeks of this confrontation back and forth, getting himself slightly potted in order to fly the footage back, get it on the wire, and then get back to Little Rock so he could get up the next day. It's the kind of demands that you don't always know about in journalism.
Did you come across any footage of him drunk on camera?
No, I'm sure that he was well sobered and maybe he even learned how to fly by the end of that experience.
Right. Mm-hmm. I've heard stories that in some places in the South, some of the network news was blocked out because they thought that the network news was being too sympathetic to the civil rights protesters and they didn't want to, you know, gain the sympathy of Southerners who were watching. How much did that actually happen?
Well, I think it happened most in the very deep South. There are wonderful, not wonderful, there are classic stories of stations in Mississippi and some in Alabama, but where they had, at that point, the networks weren't necessarily exclusive to one station, so people could pick up the network feeds of a number of stations. And there's one station that should remain nameless, but instead of having the National Broadcasting Company and the Columbia Broadcasting System there, it had the Nigger Broadcasting Company and the Colored Broadcasting Company. I mean, there was, once this began to happen, there was intense and immediate hostility because they perceived not only the networks were finally recognized for what they were, Yankees, and they were Yankees who were out to play a role as they had 100 years before during the American Civil War, which, as we know, really continued in the South until the mid-60s.
And going back to look at all the press coverage of the civil rights movement, what role do you think that the black press played, and what were some of the contributions that they made that you wouldn't have seen, say, in the networks or in the newspapers?
Mm-hmm. Well, people really forget now that for 100 years, the only real information sources that black people had about their own lives was, in fact, the black press. And even now, today, it still plays a very important role. But without people like Simeon Booker and Jimmy Hicks and Alex Webster and really just hundreds of other reporters and people working on stories like this, they never would have. These stories existed before the network news discovered them, and the civil rights movement had gone on for many, many years. The white press would never have been aware of the Harlem Renaissance, much less the American civil rights movement, without, in a real sense, what the black press was doing. And in show one, people will see Jimmy Hicks, who was really the dean of American black reporters. He was with Till. He was throughout this entire period. He died 2 months after we filmed him. As did many, they didn't die 2 months, but we've lost probably six people that we filmed over the years since we started in 79. Jimmy Hicks was a rare and really a quality journalist who understood the circumstances where he was and played an important role because they would go and cover these events and get them back out to the American black community.
Is he the person who decided to publish the open casket photo of Emmett Till's body?
No, actually, the publishers of that are Jet Magazine, which is John Johnson's enterprise in Chicago. But that's an interesting story because a part of the what happened with that, the for those who don't know the story, Emmett Till went south. He was 14 years old. He was on a summer respite from Chicago. His mother had warned him about the South, but what a 14-year-old ever listens carefully, and he was kind of a feisty kid to begin with. And he had a picture of his white schoolmates in Chicago from his school, and he showed that around and said, when he pointed to one of the white girls as his girlfriend, in fact, classmate. But and he was challenging the sort of really hesitant attitudes of his Southern peers, and he said, well, he'd talk to anybody, and they said, well, why don't you go in there and talk smart to that white woman, and the woman who ran a local store. And he went in and bought something, and as he was leaving, he turned around and said, bye, baby. Now, you know, he didn't understand that was a killing offense in Mississippi in 1954, but it, indeed it was, and the woman's husband came 2 days later with a brother-in-law and took him out to scare him. But he didn't scare. He was a tough kid, and nor did he understand, I think, just where the hell he was. And for finally unable to scare him, I think the frustration level reached a point where they simply beat him badly, and they shot him and threw his body in the river. Part of what happened then was when the mother was notified, the body was found, the uncle identified the body, and the sheriff agreed to have it shipped by train back to Chicago on the condition that the casket wouldn't be opened, quite aware, I think, of the condition of the body. And the mother, to her credit, because it had to be painful for her, broke the deal. And when the casket arrived in Chicago, she not only opened it, but she had the body on display for a period of time. And for most of us of that generation, certainly most black Americans, that picture in Jet Magazine was the emotional trigger because parents couldn't protect you from it. It was something that kind of sat in your soul. And for a lot of people, when the sit-in movement came 6 years later, it was the picture of Till that I think most of us, you know, carried around with us.
You know, photographs in newspapers and magazines have become much more explicit since then. You know, even in war footage, stuff that was always kept from readers is now shown. But I think it was really unusual to have an explicit photograph like that of a really badly beaten body, you know, to be published in a magazine. How was that editorial decision made?
Well, I think the Jet always had a somewhat sensational approach to life. But I think this was clearly a political judgment that they agreed and they understood what the mother was doing. So it kind of met both criteria. An interesting thing about this footage, if you look at these six films, there's violence in them. There's no argument about that. But for some reason, it seems more terrible. And by that, I simply mean that we've gone through much worse things since. If you look, any day of coverage in South Africa with necktying and all this awful stuff is really nine times more worse in terms of violence. Vietnam, in the footage that we lived through from Vietnam, or even the riots that followed the civil rights period, all of it is much worse in terms of violence. But because of the quality of, I think, of the innocence of the people who are playing roles in this or putting their bodies on the line, there's a terrible quality to it that seems much worse. And I'm not sure what it is. I've looked at it. You watch the footage on the Selma Bridge, and there's sort of an awful tension before they begin to be beaten. And it's I don't understand why, but I've heard audiences now, sharp intakes of breath, unable to sort of incorporate this. Maybe it's that we're Americans and, you know, who knows. But somebody else will have to answer why it seems to have such an impact on us.
Well, the issue seems so awfully clear cut. It you know, who would stand up for segregation now? I mean, even people who stood up in front of microphones and basically said, over my dead body, will black people enter this school, wouldn't, I don't think, say anything like that now. It just seems so clear-cut. And you're watching people who are obviously trained to be nonviolent and just being attacked. It's really, it's quite something to witness again. But this reminds me of the Vietnam television series, which showed us really brutal recapitulations of the war. And there was an answer program that was made to that from a group who thought that the Vietnam television history was biased from the anti-war perspective. And a documentary was created that had a follow-up discussion series that it was an attempt to present the other point of view, saying that the Vietnam series was biased. Do you expect that anybody would make that charge against your series? Are you prepared for a counter program to be placed before PBS for broadcast?
Oh, I'm prepared for anybody that wants to take a crack at the series. We spend a lot of time with our historians. We spend a lot of time in study and research, and I'll put the historical accuracy of the series up against any challenge, because I think we've done the best job you can do to make certain that it's firmly anchored. But that doesn't mean the series doesn't have a point of view. And the point of view is simply that this was an extraordinary period in American history, that it was a win for the country, that there was nothing to suggest that that is what should have or could have happened at that period in time. In fact, it should have deteriorated into a certain kind of violence that would have left us all scarred from the confrontation. In fact, something quite different happened. If someone has a different interpretation of those events, and I think there are a couple that are possible, then so be it. I have no problem with them putting it forth.
I'd really like to hear what you think the other perspectives would be. Like, if someone was doing an answer program, what the perspective might be?
Well, if the truth be known, I mean, I suspect we're going to have more trouble from people who were in the movement and around it than we are from people from the outside. But, if I put on a different hat and just said I'm a conservative and, you know, I'm sick of hearing about this stuff and, yeah, this happened and now I'm going to tell it the way I think it should be told, I think I might say, maybe they should have done it a different way. Maybe I know some people have said to me that the nonviolence was a bad choice, that it allowed the movement to be co-opted. And again, this isn't the conservative saying it to me, though. The other is I have heard is that the movement was misusing the energies of the period, and that they've been channeled into self-development and to different kinds of Booker T. Washington approaches to life, then everything would be much better. I'd like to see somebody try to make that case in the environment of the 50s South, but it's certainly they're worth it. Yeah. They're welcome to try.
Eyes on the Prize has a companion book. Mm-hmm. And in the book, there's a lot of history told about the civil rights movement. There's some very interesting sidebars, including an interview that you reprint with columnist and broadcast commentator James Kilpatrick. Did I say an interview? I didn't mean an interview, but I meant a column that he wrote.
Right.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And this was a column defending school segregation, mm-hmm, and objecting to integration. And I just want to read an excerpt of it because I think it's really interesting. I don't think he'd make a statement like this today.
Well, he might. He wouldn't. We tried very hard to have him talk to us, but he's one of the few who didn't.
Would you like to read this?
No, you're probably a better reader. Go ahead.
It's arguable, but I'll take a crack at it. This is James Kilpatrick, and he said, on the contrary, the Southerner rebelliously clings to what seems to him the hard core of truth in this whole controversy. Here and now, in his own communities in the mid-1960s, the Negro race as a race plainly is not equal to the white race as a race, nor for that matter in the wider world beyond. By the accepted judgment of 10,000 years, has the Negro race as a race ever been the cultural or intellectual equal of the white race as a race? This we take to be a plain statement of fact, and if we are not amazed that our northern antagonists do not accept it as such, we are resentful that they will not even look at the proposition or hear of it or inquire into it. It's really interesting to go back and read a statement like that by someone who's still a pretty visible
opinion
giver.
Well, one of the things we do in this series, and I think that has not been done before well or even at all in some cases, is to give the dimension of the white community's participation in this whole period. And in fact, the white community is a larger player in this than blacks in many ways. They're certainly a larger beneficiary in some ways. And what Kilpatrick's column reflects is not only is it the point of view of some people today, which is a little frightening, but more importantly, it reflected the intellectual community in the White South who had this rationale firmly embedded in their souls, and that the opposition to this was not simply the Klansmen, who were a pretty clear, violent opposition that was a portion of the white community. This was reflected throughout the intellectual South. It was reflected further than that into the North. It makes it even more important to understand that the contributions of this period really began. They were the contributions of what Black Americans did during this period was overcoming not simply a somewhat ignorant Southern racist, but this kind of insidious and intellectual racism that really does great damage to a people.
We said Kilpatrick wouldn't go on record for the series. Were you able to find any of the intellectual defenders of segregation who were willing to talk and look back at their perspective then and share what they were thinking now?
Well, there were a couple rules about the series that you should understand. One is that there are no analysts or commentators in this series. They are all people who were first-person witnesses. And the narration simply tries to lead people to a moment in history and then let them draw their own conclusions. We're not trying to tell them how to feel or what they should feel, I think, although the impact of the footage is inevitable if you allow yourself to be impacted on. And we were able to go out after a number of white participants who hadn't talked to other people who tried to do this job, because I think they got a feeling we were serious, and I also think they began to understand we weren't going to cheap shot them and just try to make them look bad. We weren't starting from a position of righteousness that, we're right and you're wrong, although they knew from the beginning what we were doing, that we weren't making the AIM version, if indeed that would be a counter version of this subject. And so we had people like William Simmons, who was the man who was founded and really ran the White Citizens Council in Mississippi, one of the absolute opponents of the American Civil Rights Movement, who's on camera. And we let him have his say. He says what he says, and I think he would agree with that statement by Jim Kilpatrick. We also had people like George Wallace, when you see him over the span of the series and you listen to him now, I think that, to me at least, it's pretty clear that George Wallace was not the consummate racist that he appears to be in this early footage. I think he's an absolute opportunist. I think that's probably what hurts his soul the most now, as he's very much a tormented man. And that is because if you really believed it, and I think Kilpatrick probably really believes it, then it's less painful now because you haven't really gone against your beliefs. But if you know you simply manipulated it for the moment because you sensed the political benefits, and as George said, I ain't going to be out niggered again, when he lost an early campaign, and he never was again. And he will take you into his office, and he will point out, as he did to the Kelly Crosley, our producer, and his honorary degree from Tuskegee, and his Black press secretary, and he will look almost, I think, with longing at the expectation of perhaps being able to recover that moment in history. But I fear that for him it's a very painful experience, and he would now say, well, I never really, even if I did, why won't you, rejuvenate my image the way you did for Lyndon and some other people, which is what he says. So you get a range of white resistance spokespeople, some like Simmons, who I think he doesn't say it directly on camera, but he doesn't have to. I think if you listen to him, you know that he still feels that blacks are not equal and that he was right all along. To people like Wallace, who are willing to confess the political opportunism, to other people of the White South who simply needed to be confronted by this to indicate their change.
Did you include footage of Wallace confessing to opportunism?
No. I think that's a conclusion a viewer will draw rather than something that he says. As he tries to explain his position on these matters, I think it becomes fairly clear.
Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Henry Hampton, and he's the executive producer of a new public television series called Eyes on the Prize, which is a history of the civil rights movement that includes remarkable footage from networks and TV stations and archives of the civil rights movement. The series premieres tomorrow at 9 o'clock on public television. You can see it on Channel 12 in the Delaware Valley at 9, and it's a six-part series that continues for the next five Wednesdays. You said a little earlier that you thought if there was criticism, it would probably come from people within the movement, and there really were so many different groups within the movement, many of whom disagreed with each other in their approach. Did you want to address that directly in the series? And what I'm thinking is that I think in most movements where there are differences of opinion, people don't want the outside world to know about it. It's like you keep your dirty laundry to yourself, you know, you don't hang it outside. And there are just so many political and social groups that don't want outsiders to know about what the differences within the group are.
And usually with good reason, because they will be immediately exploited by people who are out to get both of them.
Sure, it makes you really vulnerable.
It does. But when you're telling the history from this perspective and from this far away, one of the fascinating stories is how the movement held together as long as it did, because you have these intense personal conflicts, basic philosophical differences between the way SNCC wants to go about pursuing their objectives and the way the ministers of SCLC perceive their role. And it's hard to say in retrospect who was right and who was wrong. We celebrate Dr. King's holiday, but there are probably a generation of young people who were advocating the SNCC position who are equally worthy of honor because they fought the good fight and they did an awful lot of the groundwork and homework that was necessary for SCLC to come in and use the charismatic approach to mobilize a community.
Do you think history would say that they were both right because they were operating on two different levels, appealing to separate groups of people and, you know, cover, you know, the more different approaches you have, the more fronts you're able to cover?
Well, one of the things that I came away from this, that I thought I knew this period before going into it. I'd read a lot about it and I had lived through a portion of it. But as you go into it and you get more and more involved in the intricacies of what was going on, one of the things you come away with is really a tremendous respect for the intelligence. I mean, these people were smart, and sometimes they were lucky, but it only becomes luck, you know, if it happens once. If it happens five times, it's intelligence. And the appropriate tactic at the right moment is just remarkable. And the fact that a lot of these weapons and instruments didn't exist before this movement started to happen, or if they existed, they had not been used in this country for years. The manipulation of media, the use of direct action, all kinds of tactics that are applied. You have this wonderful sort of invisible club that Malcolm X provides, because he stands quietly and looks at the camera and says, "And if you don't deal with Dr. King, you're going to deal with me." That's a very effective weapon to a nation that knows it's sitting on the top of a powder keg, and perhaps this choice being offered by the Martin Luther King Jr. is more rational and reasonable than taking a chance on the cities.
Did the difference in organizational styles and in political strategies and everything cause conflicts for you, deciding like which direction you wanted to follow? Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether you were going to identify more with the more aggressive style of Malcolm X or the more peaceful style of Martin Luther King. And
Well, I mean, it caused all kinds of problems for me, because I had this wonderful background in education. And I remember sitting in a dining room, I think at Leverett House at Harvard. I didn't go to Harvard, but Malcolm X was there doing a presentation in 64 or in there somewhere. And he was talking about the need for black people to take in charge of their own lives and the devil white man. And I stood up to defend the reasonable qualities of integration and the fact that what was this radical talking about. And he dissected me with such precision and technique. And he left me my underwear, I think, and every time I sat down. It was a constant conflict, because intellect, you knew Martin Luther King and his strategic brilliance, the philosophy was one thing, but the strategic brilliance of nonviolence was right. But my heart and soul was with those kids who had denims on and had been out in the field and were closer to my generation. So you wanted to be one of the young Turks of SNCC. So it was always a conflict of which side to go with. And in fact, most of us ended up going more with Dr. King's sort of within the system philosophy, although I got very involved in the Black Caucus movement within the churches, and I'm a great believer in some of the SNCC philosophy about the fact that change will only come to communities that demand it themselves.
Can you remember what Malcolm X said when you defended King?
I think my ego has has protected me from it. But he was gentle. I remember him looking at me with this sort of look of vague amusement, and before he started to, this was a man who had been to Oxford and handled that all right, so I was no great obstacle to him, and he just, but he was kind. I remember that, and I remember being kind of thankful so I could finally sit down and get out of the line of fire.
I think that for people who become active in any movement as a student, you really have a crisis once you're not a student anymore, because at that point you actually have to have a job, and most jobs don't give you the ability to work within your political beliefs. Either they violate your political beliefs or they just table your political beliefs while you're at work. Was that hard for you to find a way of making a living and of being an adult and still maintaining the political and social beliefs that you had?
Well, I've always had great luck at certain kinds of jobs. This job with the Unitarians was terrific because I spent my work life going around the country dealing with people who were social liberals and radicals. I had a great history from Emerson forward. And they were involved in the great social issues of the time, beginning with the Civil Rights Movement and the anti-war movement, and then they moved on to the litany of things that emerged out of that period. And then I started my company.
The media company, Blackside,
in 1968. And so I've literally worked for myself and been able to put the two things together, to work on things that I believe in and care about, along with being professionally a filmmaker and in communications. So I've avoided the conflict that I think most people find between jobs that don't allow them that kind of freedom. And it's a schizophrenia I don't envy, because I think a lot of people end up frustrated by their inability to do either well.
You've had your company it's going on 20 years now. It's a really long time.
Yeah, I love filmmaking, and it's because it's if you get bored easily, which I do, there's always a new subject to make and do, although this one took 7 years, so I don't bore too easily. But more importantly, it's the elements that can be applied to a subject. And, I mean, running a company like this, there are the scholastic academic needs of any subject that you approach. There's the entrepreneurial need of going out and finding the money and raising capital. There's the managerial need of organizing a group of people toward a given task. So it has all the elements of, and then, of course, there's the creativity of actually making the product. And at the end of it, there is something there, whether you're happy with it or not. At the end, there's a set of films or cassettes that is real evidence that something happened. So it's a wonderful business in that regard.
I think that television networks have been moving away from documentaries in the past few years. Mm-hmm. Have most of your documentaries been designed for broadcast on television?
Well, no, we've only done about 4 or 5 major documentaries for network television. One on the Black family, one on teenage pregnancy, one on outpatient departments in American hospitals, and then the civil rights documentaries. The way you keep a production company alive over many years, as I did, was to you take a lot of different projects, and we got a good reputation at making films that had effective social change and behavioral change themes. And so you would do lots of nuts and bolts stuff, like we did all the training materials for the 1980 census, and we did films for one of the most controversial set of films I ever did was for the Marine Corps. It was at a time when the Marines weren't terribly popular. And I had started this company to offer minority communities an opportunity and an alternative for a competitive media professional firm, so that if they had a point of view that they couldn't get the networks to represent, or they couldn't get somebody to do, they would be able to come to me. And it was very much a gun for hire by the right people concept. And some black Marine officers came to me, and they were said, look, we're less than 1% of the total Corps officer group. And at that point, the enlisted ranks in the Marine Corps were shooting off the scale. It was 20, 25% and headed upward. And they said, you're going to have a Corps that's substantially black and no officers to lead it. We want to recruit some people as officers. And I had a board shareholders at that point who were, I think they would have been happier if I just said, I'm going to produce a porno film, because they were very much involved in the anti-war movement and people were not happy with the war at all. But I made a successful series of films for them to recruit officers, because I thought that they deserved the right to do that. And I also felt that they were right in their instincts that the Marine Corps wasn't going to go away. And then if you were, unless you were a pacifist, you're going to need a military. And there were a number of black Americans in that service. So whether you agreed with it exactly or not, you were going to, you had to participate. So.
That's an interesting conflict for you to have to resolve. Mm-hmm. Do you feel good about the way you did it?
Yeah, I do, especially because I love, first of all, if I were going to fight a battle, I would probably like the Marines on my right flank, if you, and I learned a lot making those films. In fact, I'm going to use some of the things I learned in the next, another project I'm working on, which is the nature of American leadership. How they take basically raw material and turn them into leaders. It's not something that you're born with, according, it's something that they do to you, and they put you through this series of events and techniques that if you survive them and you grow, you come out a pretty good leader of people. And I think that those techniques can be extracted and applied to some people in I call it the serf class rather than the underclass, because I think we should call them what they really are in this society.
We only have a couple of minutes left, but I know that the Eyes on the Prize series is a 6-part series, but I understand you're working on another series of 8 programs that will document the post-civil rights movement, the effects of the civil rights movement. What issues are you going to be looking at in the subsequent 8 programs after the series that we're beginning now?
Well, they're wonderful issues, and one of the ideas of this series is to give people some historic perspective on this, because they tend to get it all mixed up. I mean, the assassination of Martin and Bobby are tied in with the March on Washington, which is tied in with Montgomery. It's all big, one squishy piece of history, and in fact it was very clear, very distinct historic periods. At the end, that Selma marked a tremendous moment for the country and for the civil rights movement. It was a victory like none other. And after that, as you enter the next phase of the period of what we'll call the civil rights movement, although I think this begins to change into something else at that point, you enter the time when the movement goes to the North. You enter the time and the cry of black power and black empowerment. You enter a time when something called the Black Panthers emerge, which are a wonderful story all by themselves. One of the programs is going to be a biography of a riot that is something we still don't understand as a phenomenon in our cities. And you have something called the Great Society, which enters into this, where you have what has basically been a rural Southern movement that's essentially usurped by the president and Northerners and turned into this enormous, expensive attempt to change the country, and the remedies that are emerged. I mean, where did affirmative action come from? Where did busing come from? How did they emerge as the chosen strategies, and who chose them? All the implications of this period suddenly burst onto the national scene, and they get less clear, but they're no less important. In fact, I think they're probably more important than this first period, and we're going to track it.
When are those going to be ready for broadcast,
A couple of years.
Oh.
Sorry.
Okay.
I need to take a rest.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for being here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, and I hope people enjoy the book and the series, because, a production team gave a good portion of their lives to them. So.
Yeah. Well, the name of the book and the series is Eyes on the Prize. The series is on public television, and you can see it in the Delaware Valley on Channel 12 beginning tomorrow night at 9. It's a 6-part series, and you can see it for the next subsequent Wednesdays at 9. The book, Eyes on the Prize, is published by Viking. My guest has been Henry Hampton, who's the executive producer of the series and the founding president of Blackside Productions, which is the producer of the Eyes on the Prize series. Well, it's about 3.5 minutes to 5. We'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening later this week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Well, traffic is fairly light this afternoon. There is some sluggish driving on the expressway westbound between South and Vine. No more than a 5-minute delay. Eastbound, we're in good shape. No delays along Interstate 95. In New Jersey, a quarter-mile delay at the Walt Whitman tolls. 42 is okay. There is 70 eastbound is slow, approaching the area of Marlcrest Road. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth for 91 FM WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Superfresh Supermarkets. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined for a return visit by Shruli Blotnick, a business psychologist who's written several books analyzing people who have been in business for many years and the effect of their professional lives on their private lives. His new book is titled Ambitious Men, and in it he tracks men who've had very ambitious careers and see how their ambitions have affected their working lives and their private lives. Thursday afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll have a discussion on the Iran-Nicaragua affair. My guest will be Ken Sharp, a political science professor at Swarthmore College, who is an expert on U.S. Central American relations. And with us will be Daniel Pipes, the director of the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is based in Philadelphia. And he's an expert on the Islamic world. So that's at 4 o'clock Thursday afternoon. Friday on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll feature a panel discussion with lesbian mothers. And Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be Grammy Award-winning jazz vocalist Bobby McFerrin. So that's coming up in the next few days on Fresh Air. I hope you can be listening. The engineers for today's show, Paul Keller and Ron Barron. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Amy Salad. Assistance from Marty Moss Cohen. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered, coming up next.
Fresh Air was funded in part today by a grant from Eichler & Moffley Realtors, with offices in Chestnut Hill, Bluebell, and Doylestown. Eichler & Moffley Realtors, bringing buyers and sellers together for more than 25 years. And English Greenhouse Products Corporation, designers and manufacturers of greenhouses, glass structures, and solariums for architecture, industry, and the home. English Greenhouse is proud to support Fresh Air and the free exchange of ideas.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Wendy Kaufman with All Things Considered.
Japanese certainly have showed us how to be aggressive, and I think more small companies should go over and do just what I did, just absolutely demand to get in, push their way in, and be more aggressive.
American businessman John Stolenwerk wanted access to the Japanese shoe market. He got it, succeeding where professional trade negotiators have failed. His story tonight on All Things Considered.
Also on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones up for the 13th straight day, a record.
On Capitol Hill, a big victory for a very controversial senator.
A Texas roundup of jurors, almost 60 brought in off the streets.
An invitation for Mikhail Baryshnikov to dance at the Bolshoi.
That and more coming up tonight on All Things Considered, but first we have this hour's top news.
I'm Frank Stachow. Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina today won a bid to oust Indiana's Richard Lugar as the ranking Republican on the influential Foreign Relations Committee. Lugar is the former committee chairman and had received unanimous support from GOP members of the committee to continue as the ranking Republican. But Helms cast the battle over the seat as a defense of the Senate's cherished seniority tradition, and that argument carried a lot of weight. Today, the 45 Republican senators gave Helms the seat by a vote of 24-17. The city of New Orleans has attracted its first major party convention ever. Today, the Republican Site Selection Committee chose New Orleans to host its 1988 convention. Mary Foster reports.
Republican Site Selection Committee Chairman Frank Fahrenkopf says holding the 1988 convention in New Orleans should help his party's effort to attract voters in the region. That and the size of the Superdome, which seats 70,000 people, were given as the main reasons for picking New Orleans over Kansas City, Missouri, or Atlanta, Georgia. Locally, officials who've been building the convention business to help offset the slump in the oil industry are looking forward to a big payday and intense national publicity. The Republican convention is expected to put $50 million in the city's economy. Although landing the Republican convention is being hailed as a major event for the city, there's also some bitterness. The Republican contract requires exclusive use of the Superdome for 6 weeks prior to their convention, apparently ruling out the city's effort to host the Democrats as well. Democrats say New Orleans is still a contender for their convention, however, and local officials hope to be able to work something out. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Foster.
White House Communications Director Patrick Buchanan will not be one of those considered at the Republican convention. Buchanan said today he will not seek and run for president in 1988. Many conservatives had urged him to seek the nomination, but others said a Buchanan campaign would mortally wound the campaign of Republican Congressman Jack Kemp. President Reagan has discussed his recollections of the Iran-Contra affair with Chief of Staff Donald Regan and White House Counsel Peter Wallison, according to spokesman Albert Breshear. Breshear said today they held at least one lengthy meeting since the first of the year. He says the meetings are intended to construct an official chronology of events related to the Iran controversy. Breshear says the White House has received a request for an appointment with the president from the Tower Commission, which is looking into the role of the National Security Council. Officials indicate the session will be held after Mr. Reagan's State of the Union address next Tuesday. The Justice Department today formally requested the extradition from West Germany of Mohammed Ali Hamadi, a suspect in the hijacking of TWA Flight 847 in 1985. The U.S. has promised the West German government that Hamadi will not face the death penalty. Bond today for the first time linked the arrest of Hamadi to the kidnapping in Beirut of a West German businessman. Deidre Berger reports.
For days, there have been rumors in Bonn that West German Rudolf Cordes was kidnapped in Beirut last Saturday to obtain the release of suspected terrorist Mohammed Ali Hamadi. Today, Government Speaker Friedhelm Ost confirmed the link between the arrest and the kidnapping, but refused to give further details. According to a report in tomorrow's edition of a Cologne newspaper, Cordes is in the hands of the radical Shiite organization Hezbollah, or Party of God. The report says the government has been given signs that Cordes is still alive. The West German news agency, DPA, says the suspected terrorist Hamadi is a brother of Hezbollah's security chief. DPA says the brother arranged the kidnapping in Beirut of the West German businessman. For National Public Radio, this is Dietra Berger in Cologne.
An unarmed Minuteman I missile was destroyed by the Air Force today on a test flight over the Pacific Ocean. The Pentagon says the missile was carrying a dummy warhead when it went off course. This is NPR in Washington. The stock market edged up slightly today, marking a record 13 consecutive days the stock prices have advanced. After a seesaw day on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 2 points to close at 2104.47. The old record of 12 consecutive gains was set late in 1970. Volume today very heavy. 225 million shares changed hands. Advances led declines by about 30 issues. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 3 cents. The dollar rebounded on major world money markets today, staging a rally against the yen on the Tokyo exchange. The dollar closed at 152.25 yen, up 1.8 from yesterday's close. Japanese Finance Minister Keiichi Mizuzawa leaves Tokyo tomorrow for Washington to meet with Treasury Secretary James Baker. The hastily arranged meeting was called to seek U.S. help in stabilizing the dollar. More from Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
Mizuzawa reportedly will seek another meeting of the group of five, including West Germany, France, and Britain,
to coordinate financial and monetary policies. It was the G5 which, in September 1985, cooperated in an effort to help the United States cut its trade deficit by lowering the dollar's value against the major currencies. But that effort so far has yielded no significant improvement. Japan's total trade surplus, for instance, nearly doubled last year to almost $83 billion. Miyazawa's job is to convince the Americans Japan cannot stimulate its economy and balance trade without a stabilization of world currency rates and a coordinated round of interest cuts. If he is unpersuasive, observers say, his failure could accelerate the dollar's historic plunge. For National Public Radio, this is Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
The savings and loan industry announced a plan today to bail out the FSLIC, which offers federal insurance for thrift institutions. The U.S. League of Savings Institutions says it wants to borrow $5 billion for 2 years to supplement the FSLIC's dwindling reserves. The FSLIC insures each account at member banks for up to $100,000. The agency is now in danger of running out of money, with the closing of 21 thrifts last year and more expected in 1987. The industry's bailout plan differs from one proposed by the Treasury Department, which would raise a larger amount of money. The League says debt service in the Treasury proposal would place a difficult burden on healthy thrifts. Rush hour traffic to and from New York City was a bigger mess than usual today because of a strike against the nation's largest commuter railroad. With the Long Island Railroad shut down, commuters packed into cars and buses, creating 40 miles of jammed traffic. Nassau County Police estimated a threefold increase in auto traffic on thoroughfares leading into the city, and a rush hour accident on a midtown tunnel further clogged traffic. Contract talks between the railroad and eight unions resumed today. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Frank Stachow.
It's All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Wendy Kaufman. Another record-setting day on Wall Street. For the 13th consecutive day, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose. That surpasses the previous string of winning days set in 1970. But overall, the stock market today was mixed. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
On another day of wild swings up and down, the record was set with a very modest gain. The Dow was up just less than 2 points, and overall, the stock market was about even. According to professional investor Ray Yavna, there is so much new cash coming into the stock market that the flow prevents the market from going down.
Each day they've been waiting for it to pull back so they can come in, and that's what's happening now. On all these pullbacks, the market just doesn't settle back because new money comes in.
Today's record of consecutive winning days comes among a string of new records for the stock market. The Dow Jones average passed 2,000 for the first time ever on January 8th, and it set 12 new record highs since then. And trading in 1 week past the 1 billion mark for the first time ever last week. Stock specialists point to many factors that have propelled the market forward so quickly. The new tax system brought about a lot of stock selling near the end of 1986 to take advantage of better tax treatment of stock profits. Now investors have propelled all that money back into stocks. There is evidence of greater foreign buying of stocks, in part stimulated by the falling value of the dollar, which makes it cheaper for foreigners to buy American shares. There is also some evidence that the smaller individual investor is now showing interest in stocks again. The small investor has largely opted out of the stock market since mid-1983. But still, the bulk of the stock buying is coming from professionals. Stock picker Steve Lieb, who publishes several market newsletters, says the rally in the market makes sense because of slow but steady growth in the economy and the low level of interest rates. Lieb believes the market will turn down when those fundamental conditions change.
This market will make a top eventually, and it will make a top when those same factors that have been propelling it upward reverse themselves. When you do see economic growth accelerating, when you do see short-term interest rates starting to tick up, you have to become worried about this market. But right now, those factors are, you know, still very much on the side of the bulls.
Lieb says he would like to see the market back off modestly, between 50 and 100 points. That, he says, would bring out any excess speculation there is in stocks and set the stage, he says, for further advances. This is Mike Schuster in New York.
The value of the dollar recovered slightly today from what appears to be a relentless plunge to record lows against the German mark and the Japanese yen. Yesterday, the dollar slid to its lowest rate ever against the mark in 6 years and its lowest level against the yen since the end of the Second World War. It also looks less likely today that there will be a meeting soon of the five major industrial powers, the U.S., Japan, West Germany, Britain, and France, to take action to relieve the monetary situation. However, the Japanese finance minister, Keiichi Miyazawa, will be in Washington tomorrow to meet with Treasury Secretary James Baker. Hobart Rowan, economics correspondent for The Washington Post, says the Japanese minister will ask Mr. Baker's help in stabilizing the dollar-yen relationship.
The yen has risen in a spectacular way over the last year and a half, and this week, as you know, it hit an all-time record high in Tokyo. What he'd like Baker to do, I think his first preference, would be for Baker to agree to join with the Japanese in intervening in the markets to stabilize the rate, to agree on some rate beyond which the yen would not be allowed to go. That's what Miyazawa would like to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Reagan administration is being a bit disingenuous about whether or not it wants the dollar to go down any further?
Disingenuous, I suppose so. They really want the dollar to go down further, but they don't want to say so publicly. Everybody knows that that's the official position. They are, in fact, talking the dollar down. And they're doing that because getting a lower dollar, presumably, is one of the ways in which they might push the awful, horrendous American trade deficit lower. If the dollar goes down, that means the yen and the mark go up. That means German and Japanese goods cost more. That means they should be less competitive against American goods. So that's the name of the game. Get the dollar down. That will help reduce the trade deficit. The opposite, of course, happens for the Germans and the Japanese.
In Japan, let's stay with Japan. I would assume there that they're concerned with their economy getting out of control, and in the long run, the people of Japan not being able to buy goods from other countries.
That's right. Japan is, in effect, on the edge of a recession. The dollar has gone down so much, the yen has gone up so much, that Japanese manufacturers, in order to maintain their share of markets here, have had to absorb much higher costs. It's cut deeply into Japanese profits. They're making less money. And if the yen goes up even more, then, of course, the situation is worse. So Miyazawa is carrying a letter from Prime Minister Yasuhiro Nakasone to his old friend Ron Reagan. You know, there's a Yasu and Ron relationship there, urging more cooperation between the two countries. But I don't think Baker is yet